Money FM 89.3, best of the evening runway.
Regional Roundup.
Money FM 89.3, it is the evening runway. I'm Elliot Danker. It's time now to take a look at headlines from the Southeast Asian region. We will talk a little bit about Malaysia's finance ministry calling for a Malaysia-first approach to strengthen their ringgit, as well as Thailand wanting to ban recreational marijuana with a new cannabis bill. On the line with me is Nicholas Fung, Managing Director Black Dot and Director for Security and Global Affairs at the Singapore Institute of International Affairs. Nicholas, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon, buddy. I'm very well. How are you?
Not too bad, sir. And quite a few interesting topics to touch on, starting with Malaysia, calling for that Malaysia-first approach as far as their finance ministry is concerned. Easy to use these words. Sounds good for branding. But what exactly is Malaysia First?
I find it, like you said, an interesting approach. And basically, you know, the finance ministry, in response to some questions from MPs, was laying out a whole of government, whole of nation kind of approach to strengthening the value of the ringgit. As we know, it has sort of plummeted to lowest levels in 26 years, you know, since the Asian financial crisis of the late 1990s. So observers have been saying that if this carries on, there could potentially be some political blowback for Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim. You know, and it does sound like the government and the finance ministry are looking at various kind of measures to sort of arrest the fall in the value of the ringgit. The government has already, you know, tried to ensure that domestic foreign exchange market remains orderly. You know, it's monitoring the conversion of export proceeds into ringgit by exporting companies. But now the latest call is for everyone, you know, like citizens, individual citizens, you know, adopt this Malaysia first attitude, which includes buying domestic goods, investing in domestic capital markets, you know, trying to boost tourism and through different kind of campaigns and improving on the campaigns. So it's a rallying call to the entire country to try to do something about this significant problem. And, you know, of course, the impact of a weaker domestic currency. Malaysia is an open trading country, and obviously, you know, if the depreciation of the ringgit will have a high impact on imported goods like food, meat, dairy, fish, seafood, fruits, vegetables, and this then become more expensive for Malaysian citizens. So the country, we've spoken many times about the sort of economic financial woes that they're trying to deal with. And, you know, I think Prime Minister Anwar has made it one of his key priorities to improve the economy. And we could see that this is sort of an extension of that.
It's a weird one that I'm trying to understand as well. I like how you've laid all of that out, Nicholas, talking about being basically pro-Malaysian goods, pro-Malaysian tourism. I see how that can strengthen the Malaysian economy itself, but how does that link to the currency? What about, I hate to keep bringing this up, but if only we had that high-speed rail, then more Singaporeans going in and getting the Singaporeans to buy Malaysian goods, that would strengthen the economy as well. But any idea how that ties in with strengthening the ringgit, or is it more of like an after effect?
As you said, it's an after effect. You know, okay. And the strength of the currency reflects basically confidence in the country and the sort of economic progress. So, okay. You know, I think it's a good point that you raised, and one of the concerns with announcing something like this Malaysia First strategy, you know, if you look at foreign investors, launching something like this could look, it could be a double-edged sword. It could signal that the government is taking things seriously, but it could also signal that the government is getting very concerned about this, and it's sort of, I wouldn't say grasping at straws, but exploring, you know, any sort of strategy that might even be able to help. So I think that's definitely something that would weigh on the minds of foreign investors, for example, when they look at something like this. And of course, if it doesn't work, if it doesn't really make a big difference, then again, you know, observers and potential investors would be like, oh, you know, if this doesn't work and all the other policies are not working, then maybe there's, you know, it's going to be an intractable problem. And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? If people are concerned that you're not, you know, it's not a viable investment destination and they pull back on their investments, it creates more problems for the Malaysian economy. So, yeah. You know, I think we certainly hope that these different measures hopefully bear some fruit before too long.
You got to help the cost of living as well. It's like what we have here, people, basically left pocket to right pocket, for lack of a better choice of words, this is something that they surely must explore as much as, you know, looking to encourage Malaysians to buy Malaysian goods.
Yeah, for sure. You know, the cost of living in Malaysia, as you mentioned, is very high. We just have been stagnant for a while. So for the working class and the lower income groups, the rising costs will really impact standards of living. So that's why I started out by saying that this could eventually present a bit of a political problem for Mr. Anwar. You know, he has a very strong position in Parliament right now, but I don't think that's something that he can take necessarily for granted, you know, indefinitely. And he's recognized that. He's always said the economy and fixing the economy is going to be one of his key priorities.
They can borrow our CDC voucher idea.
That could work. CDC is always interesting. I mean, the launches like that, because they definitely spur the economy and get things going. But if you do it, overdo it in a sense, you could actually contribute to inflation as well. If the spending becomes, swings in the other direction.
That's a very fair point. Let's talk about Malaysia's quest to host Commonwealth 2026. A lot of reactions coming out from various politicians. Anything stand out for you so far as a former competitor yourself? What are your thoughts on Malaysia trying to do this Commonwealth 2026?
I think it's an interesting question. You know, it's been relevant to us here in Singapore as well, because the Commonwealth Games Federation basically asked anyone if they wanted to come in and take over, including Singapore. And I think the questions around hosting a major games are being raised after the Australian state of Victoria pulled out as host of the 2026 games, because the projected cost overruns were starting to look a little bit crazy. You know, I think the then state premier of Victoria said that the cost of the games would spiral to more than $7 billion from a budgeted $2.6 billion. So that's a big jump, you know, almost like three times. And as we know, with hosting major games in Singapore and the Youth Olympic Games in 2010, budget overruns happen, you know, when you have these things. And then there's a big question mark over the economic returns of hosting major games. The reason why, you know, all these hosts are pulling out, not just Victoria, but even Australia's Gold Coast pulled out its bid to step in as a replacement for Victoria, is a clear sign that the numbers just don't work. You know, they can't seem to justify doing that. And it's not just 2026. I think 2030, the host, Canadian hosts have also indicated that they're not keen to host it. So, you know, it begs the question, what's the cost-benefit returns on the investment on something like this? You know, you're talking about hundreds of millions or billions of dollars. Yes, there's a lot of pride to have a home games. You know, when the SEA Games were in Singapore in 2015, it was a chef at the time, and, you know, for sure it made a big difference for like morale and people's pride in the country. But when you look at the cost these days, it's becoming a little bit scary in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of what's the point questions going around this. One of it is talking about downsizing the 2026 version of the games, which is, again, what's the point?
It is, you know, and for a lot of these games, there's a certain amount of latitude for host countries to say, okay, I will have less of this, I will have less events here, and maybe I'll drop this particular sport and things like that. But then that sort of begs the question, what is the significance of the Commonwealth Games? I don't know many young people know what the concept of the Commonwealth is, right?
Yeah.
Former colonies of England or of the United Kingdom. And, you know, so you see, like, you know, the home countries of the UK competing as England, Wales, Ireland, Northern Ireland, and stuff like that. So it's kind of archaic, and I'm not sure that there's much resonance among spectators and fans and even younger audiences. And, you know, I always quote my good friend Lau Tio Ping, who's a veteran sports administrator in Singapore. And he says, when you host host major games, as the host nation, you don't want to just organize an event for other people to come in and sweep all the gold medals. You know, you want to do well yourself, right? So it also is a question of whether we can, as a country, excel, you know, in the medal table, as it were, for these kind of major games. So I think Malaysia is asking itself a lot of these kind of questions. They last hosted the Commonwealth Games in 1998, when, as you say, I was also competing. Apparently, the numbers seem to indicate that KL made no money from it. The KL actually posted a loss of 11 million ringgit, according to estimates over there. And it cost 200 million ringgit to host. So, you know, it begs, so the 200 million doesn't even include the construction of infrastructure like the National Sports Complex, the different type of stadia, the aquatic center and stuff like that. So when you factor all of that in, there's always a criticism that these facilities become white elephants, right?
Yes.
After the games are come and go. So as a sports fan, to me, it's sad, right? Because it's getting harder and harder to host major sporting events, or it doesn't make sense, economic sense.
Mm.
One day, maybe we've only just left with, you know, the Olympics as the as sort of the pinnacle, and nobody else wants to host the rest of it.
Yeah.
Where do athletes go? Where do sports fans go for their sports fix, you know?
Yeah, that is so true. Nicholas, I want to talk a little bit about travel. Higher fees for travelers flying out of Malaysian airports to ASEAN countries. This takes effect June the 1st. Travelers departing KLIA1 will have to pay 73 ringgit, so that's about 21 Sing dollars. Traveling from KLIA2 and other airports to all destinations will have to pay 50 ringgit. People are quite muffled by this. I mean, is this one way of trying to affect the Malaysian tourism industry?
I guess so. And I'm trying to also understand the calculus and the strategy behind this. Obviously, you know, there seems to be a targeting of ASEAN countries. The sort of fees that people have to pay have gone up, but they've gone up more for those who are traveling to ASEAN countries. So, you know, is Malaysia trying to encourage people to, if you're going to ASEAN countries for holidays, maybe you should, you know, stay within Malaysia, and encourage people to, you know, enjoy sort of domestic tourism? Because, again, you know, I suppose if you're traveling further afield, then it's necessary, right? If you're going to very far away, to maybe a different climate somewhere in Europe or something like that. But if you're going to stay in Southeast Asia, maybe the signal is that you should stay in Malaysia and spend money here.
Yeah.
Part of that Malaysia first kind of thing. But I think the rationale for this move wasn't really explained very clearly.
Yeah.
But like you said, right, lots of responses, people are asking, is this money actually going to upgrade the airport facilities, right? Which you know, seems to be the best in the world, at least according to Malaysian travelers. There are people complaining at KLIA, you can't even have a train that connects passengers to satellite buildings from the main terminals. So I think it's a bit of a question mark over how this will play out. But, you know, at the same time, the Malaysian Airports Holdings Company saw their share price jump after they announced this. So, you know, to a certain extent, it went to a 52-week high, actually, on March 13th after the announcement. So I guess it's good for the company, but the passengers seem to be the one who are going to be impacted for sure.
Okay, quick one for the final bit. Thailand, you remember the first country in Asia to decriminalize cannabis. Now they've got a new cannabis bill and they are looking to ban recreational marijuana. A bit of a U-turn here. Are they regretting the move? Talk to us a little bit about the rationale behind this, and was it wrong for them to even legalize it to begin with?
Yeah, I have a personal opinion on this. Last time I was in Bangkok, you know, in downtown Bangkok, you couldn't walk more than like 10, 20 meters without smelling the sort of cannabis smoke in the air. I had to hold my breath because, you know, obviously secondhand smoke of this sort of nature is not very good for you if you're coming back to Singapore.
Yeah.
But I think the fact that they're making this U-turn is a clear sign that the initial decision wasn't necessarily the right one. And when you look at the feedback from even people who operate in the industry, companies and people who are part of the industry, they said that they were in fact quite surprised when the initial law was launched that made it legal. And I think the question was, you know, was it a little bit fast, a little bit drastic to sort of, you know, and there's this term, the cannabis cowboys, right? People who come in and sell cannabis in an unregulated, unsafe way. You know, there were a lot of them sort of springing up in the industry. So I think there are no real definite statistics about the health impact of the sort of access to recreational marijuana, but there is something to suggest that, you know, it's not been the best for for social health, for especially for people who are more vulnerable, young people, people who are pregnant as well. So there seems to be a surge in data in Thailand of people seeking treatment for cannabis addiction after the marijuana was approved, was legalized in that sense. So you can see why they are reversing it now, and kudos to the government for taking that bold step. But there's some question about whether they've gone too far, you know, already, because when you're taking cannabis off narcotics, the narcotics list in 2022, and seeing a surge in the industry now, if they go back to like zero, I think that's going to be a little bit tricky in that sense. So the Thai cabinet is not going to assess the draft legislation and public submissions before the bill goes before parliament. I think all of us in the region are definitely going to be keeping a close eye on the steps that it takes to reverse the decision going forward.
I've been speaking with Nicholas Fung, Managing Director, Black Dot, and Director for Security and Global Affairs, Singapore Institute of International Affairs. Thank you so much for your time today.
Great chatting. Take care, buddy.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at audio.sg or download the audio app. That's AWEDIO, audio, at the App Store and Google Play.